This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Annalee Newitz. As we've heard earlier this hour, pop culture depictions of Neanderthals are just full of foolishness.
It's so easy to use Geico.com. A caveman could do it.
Which were followed by a whole cycle of Geico ads where the Neanderthals protested their negative portrayals, which led to a whole new round of jokes about how funny it was when cavemen tried to sound smart. Like this one, featuring the so-called stupid caveman from Adult Swim.
There me was, beating boulder into powder because me couldn't eat it, and magic ball land in lap. Naturally, me think, all right, free egg because me stupid and me caveman. So me spent.
But something else lurks beneath the surface of these stories. To see it, let's go back to 1953, when the civil rights movement was heating up and some states were striking down laws that banned marriage between people of different races. That year, audiences at the drive-in watched a monster movie called Neanderthal Man, in which a mad scientist uses an experimental drug to turn himself into a Neanderthal for reasons. He becomes a swarthy, violent brute who, of course, conks his girlfriend on the head and brings her back to his cave. That's when a mob of white guys with guns track them down and...
We figure on trying to smoke him out and trust to luck that she'll get away.
It's too dangerous.
Well, the only other solution is to get the state police down with tear gas.
That's just as bad.
So as this mob of randos with guns gets ready to storm the cave, Miss Marshall and her Neanderthal boyfriend emerge.
Get him!
No, don't shoot!
Flatten out, quick! We'll fire over your head!
No, don't!
Yeah, sure, it's just a monster movie. But to anyone familiar with the history of lynching in the United States up to that point, this scene probably felt a little too on the nose. Then in 1968, we got another story about our hominid cousins that was a thinly veiled allegory for racial politics. In Planet of the Apes, a group of astronauts led by Charlton Heston have gone way off course and found themselves landing on Earth in the distant future. Talking apes have replaced Homo sapiens and relegated the planet's former rulers to the status of animals. They assume Charlton Heston is an animal too, but when they lasso him like a stray cow, he shouts the movie's most famous line.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
Today, this memorable line isn't just a nerdy reference. It's a racist dog whistle. In 2014, New York politician Jim Coughlin brought this usage into the mainstream when he called then MSNBC anchor and now host of The Takeaway, Melissa Harris Perry, a damn dirty ape. And in 2018, ABC fired Roseanne Barr from her own show after a nasty tweet linking former Obama advisor Valerie Jarrett to Planet of the Apes. And it's this aspect of the Neanderthal myth that fascinates science journalist Angela Saini, who writes about the ways that science can perpetuate racism.
Very quickly after Neanderthal bones were discovered, they were recruited into existing ideas about how people thought about race in the 19th century. The bones were discovered in Germany, but one of the first things scientists did was to compare those bones to the bones of living Aboriginal Australians. In the 19th century, there was this very widespread belief in the scientific community in this idea of a racial hierarchy, that white Europeans were at the top and other races were slotted below, and also that those at the bottom of this hierarchy were, like Neanderthals, doomed to die out.
I wonder if we can blame all of this on Linnaeus, because I'm thinking about how back in the 18th century, this botanist, Carl Linnaeus, he created a bunch of the taxonomic categories of animals and plants that we use today. He also developed a hierarchy of humans, though. based on racial categories, and he always put Homo africanus at the bottom, right alongside Homo monstrous and Homo ferus, what he considered to be feral and monstrous people. So do you think it goes back to Linnaeus?
Because there were these existing racialized ideas about the world because of colonialism and slavery, that became woven into this taxonomic project. So when Linnaeus was creating these quite arbitrary categories in his head, because as we know, the human species is one human species, there are no natural subdivisions between us, he was working within what was already a wider project.
So you've written about how scientists and journalists began to talk about Neanderthals in a different way when genetic analysis revealed that they were probably fair-skinned with red hair.
Of course, we will all know that the word Neanderthal is not something we purely associate with another species of human. We also use it to describe a kind of oafish, stupid man. So there was this widespread assumption that Neanderthals went extinct because they were too stupid. They were like thugs almost. Even those comparisons that were made between Aboriginal Australians and Neanderthal remains in the 19th century, I think, point to this idea that European scientists, North American scientists at that time, thought about races in that deeply offensive, destructive way. In the 19th century, one of the very first laws that was passed in Australia was a White Australia policy. And this was about essentially breeding the colour out of Australia, brutally tearing children away from their parents, putting them in care homes where they were often abused or horrible, disgusting things happened to them. This was all justified under this racialized policy that said that this is a group of people that don't have a right to be here, that they're going extinct anyway. And science became part of that project. Now, it's become quite clear over the last couple of decades that modern humans mated with Neanderthals, Europeans in particular. When you look at the way in which Neanderthals are now being described in the media, so over the last 10 years or so, suddenly we hear them being rehabilitated. You know, Neanderthals were actually much smarter than we thought they were. They didn't go extinct because they weren't clever enough. It was some other reason. Look how similar to us they are. And that's what I find particularly galling, is that only, you know, 100 or so years ago, the supposed similarity between Neanderthals and Aboriginal Australians was used as a justification to draw living modern humans out of the circle of humanity. And now, because we see that Neanderthals have some relationship to modern day Europeans, Neanderthals themselves, an extinct species, has been drawn into that circle of humanity.
I wonder if you could talk more about the implications of this discovery that, in a sense, a lot of us are a hybrid of humans and Neanderthals who were once viewed as not human.
So there was this quite popular theory 30, 40 years ago, and it's very much discredited, called the multi-regional hypothesis, which posited that different races evolved separately on the continents on which they're found. So it sounds very 19th century, and it is. And as we know, quite categorically, you know, we are all products of the out of Africa expansion. We all evolved into modernity in Africa. But that multi-regional hypothesis has to some extent or some degree, I think, been revived with this idea that once we arrived in these various places around the world, that we interbred with other human species that were already there. And maybe that's what gives rise to our racial differences, which I think is nonsensical. But you do see in the literature and in the media, people trying to make those kind of distinctions, which to me smacks sometimes of 19th century pseudoscientific racism.
It really does. And I mean, you've talked about how a lot of the scientific theories ascribed to Neanderthals are basically just reckless speculation. Why do we keep doing this? Why does this keep happening? Why do we keep going back to these 19th century models?
So many of the power structures around us were built on slavery and colonialism. And these beliefs have become so internalized and embedded in the way that we think about each other that we believe them to be biological. We mistake it for nature. We keep coming back to it because we just cannot convince ourselves that it isn't real.
So you've talked about the multi-regional hypothesis, and I wonder if there are any other examples of the scientific speculation about Neanderthals that you consider to be equally absurd.
You know, one thing I did find really interesting was during the COVID-19 pandemic, which for me was just chock full of very weird racial speculation. You know, as soon as we saw ethnic minority disparities in health, people, even experts, you know, people who should know better, began immediately entering into racialized speculation about what they were seeing. We saw a number of scientists looking into the possibility that Neanderthal genes, and I put that in quotation marks, you can't see me doing that.
I can hear it.
were somehow responsible for why some people were more kind of protected to the virus than others. And it was suspect even at the time, because there are so many complex reasons why people are exposed to a virus and why they catch it. Within families, you see such differences in how people respond. And yet that did look to me, again, as an attempt to reinforce this theory that there are some fundamental genetic differences between big population groups. Now, since then, what further study has shown that these so-called Neanderthal genes, which people talked about conferring special protection on certain people, they're not necessarily Neanderthal genes. And that galaxy of protection that people have is actually quite well distributed everywhere. It's not as though some continents have been spared. Everyone's been hit.
So where do you see Neanderthals showing up in contemporary debates and conflicts over race? It seems like an odd figure to be showing up, and yet we see it happening.
I've spent quite a few years now doing what I do not recommend anyone else does, which is spending a lot of time online looking at what scientific racists say and do and reading their publications. They are always on the hunt for whatever within the sciences will support their racialized theories. And what they're essentially trying to do is prove that race is biologically real, that there are fundamental psychological, behavioral, intellectual differences between racial groups that can explain racial inequality in a society like the United States.
Fringy groups are arguing that Neanderthals are kind of the great white ancestor?
Not in those terms, but they're always on the lookout for scientific proof of white superiority and difference. There's very little genetic evidence to support this idea that race is biologically real. We are one of the most homogeneous species on the planet. I mean, we are more homogeneous than chimpanzees. There's more genetic diversity among chimpanzees than there is among humans. More than 90% of the differences between people are not between population groups. They're between one person to the next. So what they're trying to do is find something that will support this idea that Europeans are somehow genetically exceptional. The genes associated with lactose intolerance are distributed unevenly around the world. Europeans in some regions, and again, this goes up and down because there are many Europeans who are intolerant to milk, but far right wingers have leapt upon this idea that tolerance to milk is one of their special racial qualities that they have. They're really reaching. I mean, you have to work very hard these days to be a scientific racist, but they will look for absolutely anything.
I wonder if you could leave us with some guidelines. How would you like scientists to be talking about Neanderthals so that they don't feed into these racial myths?
What I would really love is for scientists to be educated about the history of the sciences more so that they understand the mistakes that were made in the past around race science, eugenics, the ways in which scientists entered into speculation that was completely illegitimate and pseudoscientific, and the risks of doing that again now. One of the things that I think is a tragedy, really, is that when you're trained in the sciences or engineering, and I studied engineering myself, we get very little exposure to the politics that is embedded within scientific history. Less mistakes would be made if scientists had a much broader understanding of their own fields.
What does that sound like? As someone who is listening to a scientist or, say, reading something that a scientist has written, how would you want them to explain it so that I, as the naive reader, don't come away from what they've said thinking, oh, so it turns out there's different subspecies of humanity?
When we explain things and put them in context, I think that's much better. And also hold their hands up to the racist assumptions of the past. I don't think there's any doubt that the way scientists talk about Neanderthals now is sometimes also tinged with race and racism. Is there enough introspection about that? I would say no, because it's only in hindsight, in my experience, that researchers ever hold up their hands and say, yes, we were biased.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Angela.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Angela Saini is a science journalist and author. Her latest book is Superior: The Return of Race Science. The most pernicious myth about Neanderthals is actually something you hear all the time about humans. The idea that some groups of us are destined to die out because we're inferior.
It comes back to that question of why the Neanderthals disappeared. There's lots of theories. First, of course, is that we just killed them all. Or maybe the rapidly changing climate killed them. Or maybe their social groups were so small they couldn't get enough genetic variety, which weakened them. Or maybe we simply absorbed them.
But if you look at how long they lived and how they lived, it's impossible to say that they failed. In fact, they live on in our DNA, in your DNA.
My 2.5%?
Yes! Long live the Neanderthals and all our hominin sisters.
And that's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Michael Loewinger, Eloise Bondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Eli Cohen. Thanks for all your help, Eli. This is his last week. With help from Aki Camargo. Xander Ellen writes our fabulous newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Andrew Nerviano and Adrian Lilly. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Thank you, Annalie Newitt.
Thank you so much, Brooke. It's always great to hang out with a fellow hominin.